Welcome to the PRI Review, news and commentary brought to you by the Population Research Institute at pop.org. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. Under China's new two-child policy, forced and coercive abortion and sterilizations are going to continue. Stephen Mosier, president of the Population Research Institute, explained why in his appearance this week before the Congressional Executive Commission on China on Capitol Hill. Representative Christopher Smith of New Jersey, the chairman of the commission, praised Mosier for his leadership on exposing China's one-child policy long ago. "He has inspired all of us in this work," Representative Smith told his colleagues. "They are a bipartisan group drawn from both the House and the Senate. I would note that it was Stephen Mosier who broke the story on the policy to the world and to Congress about what was going on," Representative Smith said. "Thank you, Mr. Mosier, for that. I appreciate it." PRI Review's reporter was there, and we now bring you Mr. Mosier's remarks as delivered before the committee.
I'd like to start by thanking the members of the Congressional Executive Commission on China for holding this important hearing, and particularly for you, Senator Daines, for chairing it at this point. This is a hearing that's near and dear to my heart, as it was to Jennifer's, and in a sense, in almost the same way. I was at Stanford University in 1979 when China first allowed foreign researchers to come into that country, and I was the first American social scientist to live in on the ground in China for a year and study rural life in China in 1979 and 1980 when the one-child policy began. Mm. And it swept across the Chinese landscape like a terrible hurricane, sweeping up pregnant women who were 3 and 6 and 9 months pregnant, telling them that their pregnancies were illegal. They'd been legal, of course, a few weeks before, but the party had now decreed otherwise, arresting them for the crime of being pregnant, taking them away from their homes and families, locking them up in holding pens where they were subjected to morning-to-night propaganda sessions, brainwashing sessions, we should properly call them, until they were taken by force, by coercion, under escort to a local medical center where they were aborted. In some cases, the third trimester abortions were done by cesarean section, and babies were killed at birth. I was there for this entire process, and as far as I know, I think I'm one of the only or one of the few Western eyewitnesses to the way the program is actually carried out in China, with the identification of pregnant women as criminals, with their arrest, with their imprisonment, and at the end of the day, with their forced abortion and forced sterilization. So I was there at the beginning, and I would like to say that I'm also here at the close, at the end of this barbaric policy, but unfortunately that would not be true. It is true that the Chinese Communist Party has now decided that all Chinese couples will be allowed to have a second child, or will soon be allowed once they jump through the proper legislative hoops at their rubber stamp parliament, will soon be allowed to have a second child rather than being restricted only one child, as some are now. But foreign observers who have greeted this the apparent end of the one-child policy with euphoria should understand that this does not represent a new birth of reproductive freedom in China. Those who publicly commended the Chinese leadership as if they had completely decided to abolish a policy of limiting childbearing in China that's caused so much physical, emotional, and spiritual damage to the families of the nation have got it wrong, because the Chinese leadership has done no such thing. China is not backing away from draconian birth limits because Communist Party leader Xi Jinping has suddenly developed a conscience. There's no evidence that anyone in the senior leadership has ever lost any sleep over the hundreds of millions of unborn children and newborn children their policy has killed over the past 35 years since I was first in China. There's no evidence that any of them have shed a tear for the hundreds of millions of young mothers forcibly aborted and sterilized over this same period, or had a moment's regret for China's tens of millions of missing baby girls. What does keep them up at night, and what has prompted this modification of the planned birth policy, is the dawning realization that their misguided policy is crippling China's economic growth. For at least the past 2 years, China's workforce has actually been shrinking. That's a pretty amazing statistic in the most populous country in the world. Last year, the potential workforce fell by a reported 3.71 million, almost 4 million workers, a significant number even by China's standards. At the same time, the over 60 population is exploding. According to UN projections, it is expected to more than double by 2050, reaching an astonishing 437 million people over the age of retirement. China is growing old before it grows rich, and the strains on China's nascent pension programs will be enormous. And we could, Mr. Chairman, imagine a day when the Chinese government also declares that the elderly are superfluous and need to be encouraged to prematurely end their lives. That, I think, would also fall under the aegis of the population control program. There is another reason, even more fundamental, why I'm not celebrating the end of the one-child policy. Regardless of whether party leaders allow Chinese couples to have one, two, or even three children, the underlying policy has not and probably will not change. Now, Dr. Eberstadt, Reggie Littlejohn, Jennifer Lee, and Sarah Huang have all made this point. But let me just underline the fact that the underlying policy is the policy of planned birth, Qihua Shengyu in Chinese. And under the policy of planned birth, the Chinese state, rather than the Chinese people, decide how many children are to be born in China each year. And it was none other than Chairman Mao himself, the founder of the People's Republic of China, who first put the planned birth policy in place. The great helmsman, as he was known, decided way back in the 1950s that the five-year economic plans being drawn up by the Chinese Communist Party should control not just production, but reproduction, and they have ever since. That is why the shift to a two-child policy is occurring as part of the next five-year plan, approved at the latest meeting of the Chinese Communist Party Central Committee. The official communique about that meeting, which was released by the Xinhua News Agency on October 29th, made clear that in the 13th five-year economic plan, China's leaders had decided to ramp up both economic production and reproduction. The communique itself is written in the almost unreadable pastiche of slogans that the party resorts to on such occasions, but I translate it as, quote, promote the balanced development of the population, resolutely carry out the basic policy of planned births, thoroughly implement the policy of each couple birthing two children, actively begin to address the aging of the population. So the basic policy of planned births has not changed. What has changed is the state's desire to increase reproduction, and it will, by one means or another, increase reproduction. Of course, it's already too late to rebalance the population and stop the aging of the population. That's already baked into the demographic cake. And it is doubtful whether or not the new policy will have much of an impact immediately on childbearing unless the state steps in with more coercive measures. When the one-child policy has been relaxed for certain segments of the population in the past, first for rural couples, whose first child was a girl, then for all rural couples, then for urban couples where both husband and wife were only children, the results have been underwhelming. The last tweaking of the planned birth policy occurred just 2 years ago. It was particularly disappointing to party leaders hoping for a baby boomlet. The government had announced that couples in which only one spouse was an only child would be allowed two children, and they planned for 20 million births in the year 2014. Actually, only 16.9 million babies materialized. Babies don't materialize, of course, they're conceived, but in a material society like China, we could appropriately use that term. Out of the 11 million couples eligible to have a second child, only 1.45 million actually applied for a permit. So the response was something over 10% of the population. These figures suggest that at least among China's urban population, of course, more and more people are pouring into urban centers where economic opportunities are available, couples are not eagerly waiting to fill the maternity wards. I think 40 years of antinatal, anti-child propaganda has left its mark on the Chinese psyche. The Chinese Communist Party, because of 35 years of anti-people propaganda, has succeeded in largely dismantling the most family-centered culture, one of the most family-centered cultures the planet has ever seen. Few of those people who grew up under the one-child policy, who are now the second generation of people to grow up under the one-child policy. Their parents were only children, and in many cases, their grandparents were only children. They'd rather spend their limited incomes on themselves than, say, disposable diapers. So what will the Chinese leaders do if now appears likely the Chinese people do not procreate up to plan? At present, couples are permitted to have a second child, but I don't expect the matter to end there. Soon they will be encouraged, then they will be motivated, and finally, one can imagine that they might one day be ordered to bear children. I could at this point quote Dr. Eberstadt quoting me, but I'll refrain from doing that. If this prediction sounds a little overwrought, consider what China has been doing to young pregnant mothers for the better part of two generations now. They've been visited by family planning officials, planned birth officials, who encourage them to get abortions, who then motivate them and at the end of the day ultimately take them under escort to have abortions. You could see how young pregnant mothers would be encouraged to bear children, would be subject to periodic pelvic examinations to make sure they haven't secretly gotten an abortion, and punished if they refuse to bear the children the state wants them to bear. At the outset of the one-child policy, in fact, when I was in China, then Paramount leader Deng Xiaoping ordered his officials to, quote, use whatever means you must to force the birth rate down. He went on to say, with the support of the Chinese Communist Party, you have nothing to fear. Chinese officials took him at their word, and women were rounded up en masse to be aborted, sterilized, and contracepted. Even today, these abuses continue. And they will continue, because as far as I know, Central Committee Directive No. 7 of 1983 has not been rescinded. It requires women who've had two children to be sterilized, as Reggie pointed out. It requires women pregnant with out-of-plan births to be aborted, which will be the fate of women who are pregnant with a third child. And it requires women who've not yet been given permission to have children to be contracepted. That will stay in place. It will also continue to be the case that single women in China will not be allowed to have children because all of their pregnancies are ipso facto out-of-plan births. So the same party officials who've been responsible for decades of forced abortions and sterilizations would have no qualms about enforcing mandatory pregnancy. If the higher birth rate called for by China's new planned birth policy cannot be achieved voluntarily, I think childbearing in China may one day become mandatory. What should China do? Well, China's leaders should, number one, abandon the planned birth policy altogether, the policy that's been in place since the 1950s. They should allow couples to freely choose the number and spacing of their children and have as many or as few as they desire. Number two, China's leaders should respect the consensus of the international community as expressed in the policy of the UN Population Fund. The UN Population Fund affirms that couples enjoy the right to reasonably decide the number and spacing of their children, something that China denies its own people. The National Health, number three, the National Health and Planned Birth Commission, created in 2013 from the merger of the Ministry of Health and National Population and Planned Birth Commission, should revert to its former role as the Ministry of Health and its planned birth arm abolished. Only if these reforms are undertaken will forced abortions and forced sterilizations, which have characterized China's planned birth policy from the beginning, come to an end. Now, is this likely to happen? Well, sadly, no. I think the totalitarian impulse that drives these policies is far too strong in China. From a more practical, political point of view, the planned birth policy employs far too many people. It generates far too much in the way of profits to corrupt officials through the fines for having illegal children. And it's too closely identified with the Chinese Communist Party to ever be lightly abandoned. The Chinese Communist Party has invested a lot of its legitimacy in the claim that it and only it knows how to manage the Chinese economy and that reproduction is part of managing the Chinese economy. Were it to abandon the planned birth policy altogether, it would be admitting that its management has been a failure. It has, of course, been a failure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the testimony of Stephen Mosier, president of the Population Research Institute, before the Congressional Executive Commission on China on Capitol Hill. Mr. Mosier testified before the committee last Thursday, December 3rd. This is PRI Review from pop.org. We'll be right back. Here's some great news. PRI has now released the notorious Planned Parenthood organ trafficking videos in Spanish. That's right, the struggle against Planned Parenthood needs to go global, and you can help make it happen. If you have Spanish-speaking friends at home or abroad, please let them know. Here's the story. This summer, the Center for Medical Progress revealed to the world the deep-seated corruption pervasive in Planned Parenthood, one of the world's largest abortion providers. To date, 10 videos have been released showing senior executives of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, at various stages in the process of harvesting and selling the organs of aborted babies. Planned Parenthood, a taxpayer-funded organization that receives over $500 million annually from the U.S. government, is supposed to be dedicated to the health and welfare of women. But as many have pointed out lately, PPFA doesn't do a single mammogram. Their clinics aren't licensed to. What Planned Parenthood does do is abort hundreds of thousands of unborn Americans every year. And we now know that many of its clinics are in the business of selling baby body parts, generally without the consent of their mothers. In their greed, Planned Parenthood clinics even put women's life at risk by altering abortion procedures so that especially lucrative parts and pieces of the aborted children can be delivered intact and sold. The videos released by the Center for Medical Progress have had a huge impact in the English-speaking world. Each video has garnered over 1 million views on the site of the Center for Medical Progress, while tens of thousands have seen the entire 3 hours of footage. Unfortunately, slow internet speeds and language barriers have prevented people outside the United States from watching these videos. That's why the Population Research Institute has produced a series of videos with Spanish subtitles short enough to be viewed with ease in the Spanish-speaking world. Now, all of Latin America will have the opportunity, finally, to learn the truth about Planned Parenthood. Each video unveils a new level of corruption within the abortion business. In the first video, Deborah Nucatola, Senior Director of Medical Services, can be seen sipping wine and munching salad while she describes how she obtains intact organs. I'm going to go basically crush below, I'm going to crush above, and I'm going to see if I can get it all intact, she says. Another shows the president of Planned Parenthood's Medical Directors Council haggling the price of organs. I want a Lamborghini, she says. And another, a former STEM Express employee, describes how she was forced to cut the brains out of a baby's head while its heart was still beating. Now that PPFA's illegal organ sales have been exposed, they are starting to backtrack. The organization recently announced that it will no longer accept monetary reimbursement for procuring baby parts. Instead, they will harvest the organs of babies for free. This is tantamount to admitting that they were earlier breaking the law, and it's still not free, at least to the American taxpayers who pay hundreds of millions of dollars to fund the evil empire of abortion. Finally, there is the issue of informed consent. As the videos make clear, Planned Parenthood's employees routinely harvest the organs of their little victims without asking their mothers for permission. Isn't it the woman's body? We also see how abortionists modify the abortion procedure in order to better obtain a specimen. We even hear them admit to performing illegal partial birth abortions where babies are delivered alive so that their organs can be extracted fresh and intact. Isn't it the woman's choice whether her baby's remains are to be treated this way? That's the way they argue. These women don't choose and they don't consent, and the little girls and boys who are being butchered for their organs have no say at all. Please help PRI let Spanish-speaking mothers all over the world see these videos. Just go to our website, pop.org, and click the donate button today. You'll be glad you did. Pope Francis returned from his historic trip to Africa this week, where he condemned the corruption that has prevailed there for decades, impoverishing the poor and enriching government elites and their cronies. Unfortunately, many of those cronies are international NGOs, so-called non-governmental organizations, pretending to help the poor while they cash in on fraud and manipulation. And many of those manipulators are Western governments. Here's how Barack Obama recently put it. And I quote, "We occasionally have to twist the arms of countries that wouldn't do what we need them to do if it weren't for the various economic or diplomatic or, in some cases, military leverage that we had." End quote. Well, how does America twist the arms of African countries? In the name of aid to the poor, Obama's State Department demands that Africans modernize and accept gay marriage, transgender theory, and other cultural rot. Obama's Agency for International Development pushes birth control and abortifacients, threatening countries who don't want it. We'll cancel all the aid programs for clean water, agriculture, hygiene, and medical clinics if you don't push family planning, America's cultural tin horns, tell the Africans. And these folks work hand in hand with abortionists. The fewer poor Africans, the better, is their mantra. Well, that's how Obama's wrecking crew twists the arms of African countries. Pope Francis and the African bishops have roundly condemned the entire ugly enterprise as ideological imperialism. At least the Pope can speak freely. Catholic Relief Services, the American Bishops NGO, created to help the poor overseas, remains strangely silent about this cultural imperialism. Why? Well, perhaps their arms are being twisted, too. Will they continue to receive over $500 million in taxpayer dollars a year if they speak up and condemn the most pro-abortion, anti-life government in American history? I doubt it. And neither will our Catholic Bishops' Conference. Instead, our beloved bishops call on Americans to help President Obama stop global warming. Yes, our bishops are telling Africans that they have to stop using carbon fuels. Well, what can our bishops possibly be saying? After all, tens of millions of Africans, including millions of Catholics, most of them poor, burn wood to cook their food and burn dried manure gathered all summer long from the fields to heat their homes in the winter. Are America's bishops really calling these poor people polluters? Why do they insist that poor Africans and Latin Americans and Asians stop burning these carbon-based fuels? Must Africa's poor starve to save the planet? Must they freeze in order to please the cultural imperialists? And must our bishops remain silent because they fear the loss of $1 billion a year in federal government funding? Troubling, yes indeed, and America's bishops are not alone. Let's take a look at Germany. When it comes to the Catholic faith, Germany is simply dying. And it appears that German bishops resent the enthusiasm that Pope Francis has shown for the African church. His Holiness has even said that Africa is the future of the church. That act of hope sticks in the craw of the German Bishops' Conference, which published a piece last month condemning, and I quote, the romantic, poorer church of Africa. Of course the church is growing there, they wrote. It grows because the people are socially dependent and often have nothing else but their faith. It grows because the educational situation there is, on average, at a rather low level, and the people accept simple answers to difficult questions of faith. answers like those that Cardinal Seurat of Guinea provides. And even the growing number of priests is a result not only of missionary power, but also a result of the fact that the priesthood is one of the few possibilities for social security on the dark continent. End quote. Well, if that condescension weren't enough, the article drives home its contempt by linking to Cardinal Seurat's condemnation of Western cultural imperialism, like the Germans, especially its attempt to spread gender ideology and homosexuality in Africa. So, according to the wealthy, educated German bishops, Africans are faithful Catholics because they are dumb and poor. Well, we can accept that of German Marxists, but of the German Catholic Bishops' Conference? This is a cultural corruption at its worst, a contempt that is fueled by Germany's total spiritual collapse. As millions of young Muslim men flow across their borders, virtually unimpeded and unassimilated, Germans will soon find out what spiritually animated people can do to a decadent country, for good or ill. Yes, corruption and cronies do plague Africa, but let's not pretend that other countries are immune to this foul disease. Take a look at communist China. The New York Times now reports that Chinese elites are investing billions of dollars in the U.S. housing market. But that's been going on for years. Smithfield Foods is the largest pork producer and processor in the world. It has facilities in 26 U.S. states, and it employs tens of thousands of Americans. It directly owns 460 farms and has contracts with approximately 2,100 others. But now a Chinese company has bought it for $4.7 billion, and that means that the Chinese will now be the most important employer in dozens of rural communities all over America. China is investing heavily in Detroit as well. Here's a city that's been virtually destroyed by its left-wing politicians for decades, and now China is hiring American engineers and buying supply chains and companies in vital American markets, mining Detroit for the talent that has been put out of work by the city's political corruption. Yes, it's been going on for years, but now even the New York Times has noticed that communist China has trillions in American dollars to spend, and they're spending it here. This comes first because of reckless federal spending, increasing our national debt, which the so-called People's Republic then purchases in the form of U.S. Treasury notes. Second, it comes from the gross trade imbalance between the U.S. and China, giving the communist government and its cronies hundreds of billions more to spend every year. But why are liberal pundits stunned that the Chinese are buying up not only industries like Smithfield Foods, but also factories, farms, and now residential real estate throughout the United States? To cut through the fog that usually surrounds America's journalist class, we must acknowledge a basic reality regarding communist China. It is a country ruled by a powerful, efficient, and omnipotent communist gang. The Chinese yuan, their unit of currency, still bears the image of a godlike Mao Zedong, the great leader who led the communist revolution over 70 years ago. Now, Mao's communist ideology had only one goal. No, not the alleviation of poverty, not to help the poor, but rather the acquisition, the preservation, and the maintenance of power. In brief, how to take power and how to keep it. Now, we know that when it comes to gangs, there are always those who can't shoot straight, and others who know very well that tomorrow they may be vaporized and thrown down the ideological memory hole. That's true for every criminal gang, and China is no different. That's why the Chinese elites are now looking at buying land, not only in the United States, but all over the world. As far as America is concerned, those elites are using our country as a safety deposit box for some of their excess cash, should they someday soon need to exit quickly from the people's paradise. Remember, criminal gangs are just that, criminal. That kind of life does not sow trust and confidence, but rather distrust and suspicion. Anybody in China who has any money worth talking about is either in the government, in the party, married to a party member, or paying off the party for the privilege of having money. They know that their time may come at any moment. So there's nothing unusual in the fact that the Chinese are buying up land worldwide, or that they are now the world's largest purchaser of gold. These are assets that will always have value, and their combination makes it easy for the elites to have an escape plan should the axe ever fall on their faction in the constantly roiling internal party battles. Unfortunately, the United States is not immune to corruption either. Yes, we have a tradition of civic virtue, the rule of law, and limited government. But respect for all three of these fundamental principles has eroded to the point where lies and manipulation have prospered right here at home. Take U.S. government spending. Senator James Lankford, a Republican of Oklahoma, recently released a report detailing over 100 examples of massive government waste paid for by hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars. For instance, in its totally incompetent and even dangerous stab at foreign policy, the federal government spent $4 million for each so-called Syrian rebel fighter, supposedly trained to combat the Islamic State terrorist group ISIS. What happened when these multi-million dollar soldiers hit the battlefield? They handed over their weapons to the terrorists and fled for their lives. Well, I'm sure you'll be pleased to hear that your government also spent $1.2 million to teach robots how to select clothing and dress children and the elderly. That's $1.2 million that America's children and elderly won't have to buy clothes and learn how to dress for themselves. And beyond all the wasteful spending, there's a hidden and poisonous ruse that our corrupt government uses to make us spend more money even after paying our taxes. It's called regulations. What are they? Well, we all know about the HHS contraception mandate. That's a government regulation, not legislation, aimed at our freedom and our dignity. And it's costing us tens of millions of dollars to defend ourselves against the government. Well, there are thousands more regulations that are just as costly. Not only has our incompetent government raised our national debt to $19 trillion, but just before Thanksgiving, when no one was looking, Obama promulgated hundreds of new regulations that Americans now must follow for fear of breaking the law. And Senator Lankford reports that obeying Obama's rules, not one of them passed by Congress, will cost each and every American family about $15,000. That's a lot of billions of dollars. More that the Americans have to bear along with the burden of $19 trillion of debt. And the corruption doesn't end with the Oval Office. Forced by lawsuits to reveal what should have been public information, Hillary Clinton's State Department now admits that Mrs. Clinton used her government position to meet with at least 100 of her major political donors as Secretary of State. How can we explain this flagrant corruption and flouting of the law? Well, Robert Nisbet, the famous social scientist and keen observer of American tradition, once observed that in 1913, the year he was born, the only contact that the average American had with the federal government was with the post office. Not anymore. Now you can't even go to the Idaho mountains or the Texas deserts without running into the federal government and the consequences of its corruption, mismanagement, incompetence, and even criminality. The American people have had it. A recent Rasmussen poll found that just 19% of Americans trust the government to do the right thing all or most of the time. 60% of Americans see the government as a threat to their individual freedoms. Well, that's really new, since consider, almost 100 million people today rely on the federal government's myriad of means-tested welfare programs. These reports imply that the vast majority of working Americans recognize that the government, not terrorism, is the greatest threat to their freedoms. And Rasmussen is not alone. A report released this week by the Pew Research Center tells us that most Americans think that the average citizen is much more capable of solving America's problems than the federal government is. elected officials are widely regarded as dishonest in comparison to typical Americans or business leaders, Pew reports. Public trust has tanked in government to historic lows, Pew concludes. This has been PRI Review from pop.org. I'm Christopher Mannion. Thanks for listening.